I have with me today Anthony Panozzo, who is the Managing Principal of Research Communities at Continuum. Anthony, welcome to Research World.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Tell us a little bit, first of all, Anthony, about Continuum. What is Continuum's place in the world and its vision? What do you do?
Continuum is a global innovation consultancy. We focus on design innovation, and our goal is to drive business results through creating meaningful design experiences. We are headquartered in the United States, in Boston and Los Angeles, and we have studios in Seoul, Shanghai, and Milan. We have a very eclectic and diverse mix of practitioners, ranging from anthropologists and sociologists to mechanical and systems engineers. We approach design from all aspects, from people with business backgrounds to people with digital backgrounds, people with product backgrounds, and people focusing on services, interactions, and organizations. Our goal really is to help make people's lives better around the world.
Great. So, and as you say, around the world, your focus is specifically on emerging markets. Is that right?
That is correct. We have, Continuum is a consultancy, so our work happens in what we call the client space. So, working with clients to help them achieve their growth objectives, and obviously, emerging markets right now are on the forefront of everyone's conversation, because that's where investment is being funneled. That's where the population is growing. That's where the population is the youngest, and a lot of multinationals, as well as companies that are based within those emerging markets, really are placing heavy bets on the future of emerging markets to drive their growth.
And at a recent talk that you gave at Northwestern University, you made some statements which I found to be very eye-popping. One was that emerging markets is going to change the world economy as we know it. And the other was on the middle class. You were saying this is the second boom of the middle class. Tell us a little bit more about what you meant there and why you feel this is so important.
So on the middle class front, it's pretty amazing. There's 6.5 billion people in the world right now, and at some point in the next, I believe it's 30 years, we're going to experience peak population, meaning the population for the first time in the history of the world will actually begin to decrease. The growth, where this population is happening, where it's growing, is in emerging markets, and in particular, what you're seeing is historically, there have always been more people in emerging markets than there have been people in what are commonly referred to by economists as developed markets. So this in itself is not new. What is new is that as investment is made in emerging markets, and as the speed and the access to information is dramatically increased, many people are in these countries are emerging from poverty at a rate that has never before been seen. So what you're seeing is a shift in the population curve, which is a bell curve. So you have a sort of a fat middle, which is generally your middle class, and you have fringes and tails where you have your very, very rich and your very, very poor. That bell curve is moving right, if you would, on the axis entering, where you have a very disproportionate number of people leaving poverty and entering the middle class. So this is why the middle class has become so important, because the middle class has largely driven the economy in developed nations since the late 1880s, when there was the first boom that was driven by the Industrial Revolution. So now you have these millions and millions of people who were previously poor, who are now enjoying standards of living that they had never enjoyed before. And once they are at a point where people can maintain basic needs, such as knowing where your food and shelter are coming from, and being able to rely on a more steady existence, you start to think about the world in a much more broad way. You start to try to achieve your aspirations, whether they be buying your first car or buying the first car for the family, which is a huge aspiration. The first children to go to college, purchasing, you know, the kinds of goods and services that we take for granted each day because they're part of our lifestyle. So these are, because there's so many people becoming middle class, that's why we're interested in figuring out how to help them and really make their lives better as a result of that transition. The point that you made about the changing economy, and I think that the two are very much connected. So consumers in the United States, for example, have a lot of debt. So what they have done is they have sort of followed this path of each generation doing better than the next. So I know my grandparents came here, my grandfather came here from Italy when he was about 15, and very, very poor. And he put his kids through school, and they enjoyed a middle-class lifestyle, and then they put me through school, and I've been able to, you know, continue to further that. There's a real strong sense right now that that model of the American dream is actually been, in many ways, distributed and shared throughout the world, because we are in a situation where, whether it's states, whether it's governments, whether it's personal debt, we have a lot. We're carrying a lot of debt. We're probably not going to be able to spend and consume to the degree that we had in the last 25 or 30 years, and so that consumption, which essentially drives the economy, the consumer spending, is going to happen outside of the U.S. So that's why the economy is changing so much, because the consumption model is shifting. Now, there's no guarantee, and frankly, hopefully it does not replicate the consumption model that leads to debt and waste and depletion of resources. We certainly don't want to repeat that, but certainly there is going to be consumption associated with the growth of the middle class, and that's why it's really important for our clients, it's really important for us to know exactly what's going on and how to be best prepared to address it.
So, and I think you said that there were some very startling numbers, that 93% of the world's middle class would be in emerging markets in 2030, I think you said?
Yeah, that was a World Bank statistic.
Right. And that we're adding about 70 million people a year to the ranks of the middle class worldwide.
So that's the, again, according to the World Bank, that's the growth. That's what the annual expansion is of the middle class based on their data.
And as you said, that's the equivalent of adding France every year.
Yeah. one of the G7 nations right there. I mean, if you think about how staggering that is, I mean, you know, France was originally one of the seven largest economies, at least this is, you know, post-World War II in the world. I actually read something recently that within the next 10 years, Paris will not even be in the top 25 cities in terms of population, which is sort of a shocking statistic as well. But it just shows you how much of a Euro and Western-centric view many of us have. Now, you know, one thing that I like to point out is that, you know, Continuum as a company has an office in Shanghai, and where we're focused on growing emerging markets is primarily out of there. The reason why I'm involved, and I am doing this, you know, frankly, from a very developed, you know, perch in Boston, is the curve that I and my colleagues have gone here is very represents the curve that many business leaders and designers and innovators and engineers and technologists that they're about to go through, which is they cannot rely on their own native domain and gut instinct and ability to understand the quote-unquote world around them to inspire or inform their decision-making, because they just have no understanding whatsoever of what daily life is in Bulandshahr, India, or in Jiaxing, China. So part of what our focus is at Continuum is to help people, leaders, understand what emerging markets, I mean, they know what they are, they know how important they are, but how they can actually, you know, be successful there. Some will start, like GE and Microsoft and lots of companies for, you know, within the last 10 years have opened development centers, R&D centers in India and in China and Brazil, and that trend will continue to happen, and that is largely the right thing to do. But during that transition, leaders need to understand how to be successful in emerging markets, and many of them will still have to operate from a faraway vantage point, and that's what that's a lot of the value we try to bring.
And indeed, that is a central point, I think, of what you were trying to say at Northwestern, which is that you can't necessarily go into these markets, and particularly the marketing to the new middle class, with the presumptions of the developed world behind you. You have to be able to understand life as it's lived on the ground in order to be able to design and to market effectively.
Correct. And you know, it's not a new principle. If you think about it, it's the same principle that that got people out of their offices 25 years ago, marketers out of their offices and into the field, into people's homes to really understand how people behave. There's a great quote, and I apologize, I won't be able to attribute it to its author, but the quote is, if you want to understand how a lion hunts, you don't go to the zoo, you go to the jungle. And this fundamental approach, which really is sort of underlies everything that we do at Continuum, is about understanding people. And if you understand people and what their lives are like and what they're trying to do, whether it's a very functional thing like a job that they need to get done, or whether it's an emotional thing like an aspiration or a goal that they're trying to achieve, if you don't understand that, then you run a very, very high risk of spending a lot of money and probably even more of a risk, because time is right now more valuable than money, taking a service or a product or an idea and under the basic assumption of, well, it works well here in our U.S. market. If we reduce the cost, we can sell it in India and in Brazil and in China. And as long as we're within the sweet spot of what they can afford for this, we'll be fine. And we'll make it up on volume. And whereas that is true at one level, it presumes that what people in Brazil and China and India want or frankly need is similar to what they want and need in the markets that they're currently successful in. And that's the big thing that we try to make sure our clients avoid making that mistake.
Right. You used the example in China of Pampers and how the design of Pampers for the U.S. did not translate for life in China.
That's correct. Pampers is a hugely successful brand and product here in, you know, I keep saying here in the U.S., but really in Europe and many of the developed economies. So their first foray into China, they learned the hard way. The first thing they learned was that taking a diaper that has been made for one country and cost-reducing it for another is not going to work, because what happened was where they reduced cost, they thought that they were making smart decisions. They weren't. And it's not that, you know, they're not smart people, but they didn't understand what Chinese moms, in particular the whole culture of potty training in China, they didn't understand that to the extent that they needed to understand, so they knew how to make the smart decisions about cost reduction. Make no mistake, low cost was going to drive the market, because in many ways, Pampers had to create a market in China, because disposable diapers, that market did not exist in China to the extent that it existed in the U.S. So there's no question that to help stimulate that growth, that price point needed to be very, very attractive. But what they needed to understand was where to direct their efforts in cost reduction. And because once they understood what they needed, what was important, like what the big idea for diapering in China was, then they had to bring to bear their full capability to cost reduce and innovate in materials that are cost effective and efficient in order to deliver that. And they didn't figure that out until the second time around. So unfortunately, it was lessons learned for them. But luckily, P&G is a smart enough company to learn from its mistakes and come back stronger the second time around.
It's very interesting, because clearly, you know, you delved into the whole culture, as you say, of potty training in China. How did you go about doing that, and how do you generally go about, you know, really getting deep down into the lives of people? What sort of tools do you use?
That's a great question, and I think I think we're at a point where in sort of the evolution of data collecting, especially in the marketing and consumer insight space, where we're starting to really hone and become efficient with some pretty standard tools that we've been using for some time. But one step above the tools, and I think your comment is, I think, really speaks to the approach. And the approach that we had was that we needed to get into people's homes. And I know there's a lot of debate about focus groups versus, you know, in-home direct observation, ethnographic approach, and I think they both have their strengths and their weaknesses. Certainly, when your knowledge gaps are high, and when you're entering a market you haven't entered before, or you've entered a market and you have failed, it's an important market to you, then in-home is going to give you the deepest insight. And so we chose to go into mom's homes and shadow them, and not only interview them and get tours of their spaces, but also follow them around as they went about their day. So playing with their children, taking their children to school, shopping, preparing for dinner. You know, in many ways, very antiquated views of being a housewife, but very much in play in some of these areas, and it was through that observation and that ability to have that conversation and to develop the rapport that we were able to see, see something that we couldn't have perhaps observed if we were asking moms questions or conducting a survey. Video is very important to us. One of the great things about video in the last few years is that the actual device that captures the video used to be this very obstructive box that stood between you and the person you were talking to, and it was always a barrier, and they always felt a little awkward because they knew they were being videoed. Now we use flip videos and mobile phone video equipment that's innocuous, so we could kind of set it up and have a real conversation like two people sitting side by side and getting to know one another. We have a few people in our organization, actually more than a few, that are native Mandarin speakers, but in this particular case, we're always looking for that person that really understands not only the language, but also the culture that we're trying to understand. So we partner with what we call cultural translators that help us not only translate language, but help us understand something. So we may see something and go, wow, there's the big insight right there. And the local translator who's working with us might say, actually, no, that's not that big of a deal. In fact, we've seen that many times, and in fact, there's this company that does this. And so what we think might be an opportunity actually isn't an opportunity. So I think it was, in this particular case, the ability to spend some quality time with a good cross-section of moms to observe and to understand them and then to begin to identify what we think was the big idea for Pampers. And it's one thing I'll just comment on very briefly. Continuum uses research and research techniques as a means to an end, and that end is to come up with the right idea for our clients. So one thing that we try to do is we never present an insight without having an implication and an idea, or laddering that up to an idea that we feel that our client can act upon, because we feel like giving them the insight is only half the battle. We need to envision what the implication of that insight might be, and then begin to sketch out what the vision of their business might look like if they act on this, and that's how we are able to not only communicate to a P&G, for example, what we think they should do, but help them communicate it to others within their organization, so it gets a lot of momentum around it.
Right, and an insight is not an insight unless it results in a definitive action.
Yeah, and I would never ever suggest that identifying insights is easy.
No.
Especially the new ones. What's amazing to me is, if you think that products can be knocked off quickly, I mean, I've seen a single insight be picked up and run with by competitors, within weeks, especially in China. So, which makes, I think, positioning even more difficult, because it's very hard to position around an insight when it can be knocked off that quickly.
Yeah, I can imagine that. And China obviously is a major market for you, as you pointed out. How are we defining emerging markets here? Is it really, the Brazil, India, China side of things, or are we also including African countries, Latin American countries in addition?
I love this question, because we have this debate quite frequently here. So emerging markets is essentially an economic term. I think a lot of people get offended by it, especially people who live in these countries. In fact, I had a recent conversation with a Russian colleague when I casually mentioned Russia as an emerging market. They were completely taken aback and looked at me like, Russia is not an emerging market. You know, we don't have, you know, famine and poverty and, you know, widespread, inability, infant mortality or no access to water. I mean, what they had in their mind, their mental image was a very poor base of the pyramid, you know, region or African nation. And I said, well, you know, with all due respect, it's not a cultural implication or a human implication. It's simply an economic definition, you know. And it's based on GDP. It's based on certain UN statistics, life, you know, quality of life indices, and purchase power parity of the consumers, etc. So it's purely an economic. So, and that's an important distinction because our clients, you know, are trying to grow their businesses, so they speak in economic terms. Now, how we view it internally is very different because we see a very gray scale that between countries that are either like certain countries, like if you go to Shanghai, for example, that is not a developing, emerging city. That city is a full-fledged world's financial powerhouse. And they have the tallest buildings and the best restaurants and the most beautiful architecture. They are, you know, you would never consider Shanghai emerging. You take a two-hour train ride and you will see a very emerging China, a very different China. So we try to look at it in terms of the not so much the country overall, but also in terms of a region's access or ability to sustain or to start or sustain, to start or to sustain an economy. So we have a social innovation practice that works very closely with our emerging markets community. They focus a lot on base of the pyramid initiatives. So they're looking at places where there's no running water. There's poor access to education. There's extreme poverty. And they're asking questions like, how do we enable this human capital to create an economically sustainable system so they can grow out of poverty? The first sort of wave of social innovation was frankly about, you know, doing good by, you know, here's something that will help you, but it wasn't sustainable. You know, it was very much the handing a fish versus the teaching to fish model. And so we try to look at it really in terms of how can we help achieve that improving lives, as I mentioned earlier. We look at it as how can we improve lives where, in many cases, the biggest fundamental challenge is simply creating a basic, you know, economic engine in a small village, a small rural area, and how do we help do that? So for us, it spans the spectrum from, you know, middle-class consumers who are ready to buy their first BMW, and there are a lot of them in China right now, all the way down to people who are simply trying to figure out how to, you know, make sure their kids, you know, survive past infancy and get them to school and give them a better life.
Right, but it would be fair to say then that the emerging middle class that you were talking about is predominantly going to be found in the emerging markets by the economic definition.
Correct. That is correct. And so there's certainly a wave of people joining the middle class, and then there are still, though, billions being left behind. And, you know, as a company, I know that many multinational companies are, you know, they've got a business in the U.S., they've got a business in, you know, they've got a business in Shanghai, or they've got a business in Sao Paulo, and then you get outside those areas and they don't have a business. And right now they're looking at, you know, the 4.5 billion people who are not being served in any way, shape, or form, and they're going, well, you know, I don't know how to distribute there. I don't know what to make. They don't have any money to purchase. So, all of the decisions that the foundational elements of launching a business aren't in place, so they get very anxious. But they also look at it and say, but there's 4.5 billion customers potentially. There's 4.5 billion people that could, you know, that we could, whose products and services we provide could make their lives better. And there's also a growing sense that, you know what, civilization has been around for a long time, but we sort of tolerated this idea of rich and poor. And I don't mean, you know, rich and poor in terms of like the U.S. You know, there are people that drive BMWs and people that drive Fords. I'm talking, you know, we're talking real poverty within the world. And that imbalance is becoming more and more unacceptable, especially to an entire generation of young people who look at that and they grow up, you know, with excess, seeing, you know, the economy hum in the late 90s and early 2000s, and you know what, they have everything, and so and there's a sense that the world needs to be more balanced, and I think you're going to see a huge effort towards finding ways to make models work in parts of the world where right now or historically people have ignored.
Right, but it's an interesting dichotomy because. I guess, you know, if we look at the economically emerging markets, then we have APAC, we have Eastern Europe, and we have Latin America. Just thinking of APAC in particular, what sort of, you know, let me just put it this way, which of those three do you think is really full of promise for marketers that are concentrating on that middle class right now?
That's a really good question. I think it's hard to discount Asia as probably the leading cluster of emerging markets. They have a lot going for them. One is China is there, so you know, as China grows, a lot of the countries that trade with China, that are adjacent to China, that are part of that economic zone are going to benefit. India is another huge growth opportunity because of the, you know, frankly, it's a lot more aligned, or I shouldn't say aligned, but a lot more, there's a greater cultural affinity with India and developed market countries and companies. English is, recently we did some research in India where we actually conducted the research in English. It was the candidates the participants were that fluent in English. So there's a huge, there's a seamless connection between, you know, Indian labor and Indian, capability and talent with Western. So there's a nice connection there. So I would have to say that it's that Asia Pacific is probably the primary reason. I mean, certainly we sort of have followed the same route. I mean, our first emerging markets office is in China. We're very interested in Brazil right now, as I know many other countries companies are. But Brazil's got one small issue, and that it speaks Portuguese, which doesn't seem like that big of a deal. But you have English and Spanish and Mandarin as the three dominant languages, and then there's this very powerful country with a different language. So there's a little bit of a barrier there, and their neighbors also don't speak the same language. So I think you know, Brazil is going to be a major player. South America is going to be a major player, but I still think Asia is probably going to be. I've heard someone say it will be the, you know, it will be the Asian century in the 21st century, and that is probably true.
That is probably true, and it's very interesting. As we wind up, Anthony, you know, we are researchers, ethnographers, we're insight providers. What recommendations or suggestions for successful research in emerging markets would you leave us with?
What a great question, and I hope I can offer some advice that might be new or different from I think your readers are clearly probably much more well versed in this than I am. I would say that when it comes to research in emerging markets, I think that the single biggest thing is that if you're listening, if you're working with colleagues who are based in China or Indonesia or India, and they tell you something that you just don't believe, that you just something I you know, that just doesn't seem right, that can't be right, it probably is, because there is a world and a lifestyle that you just do not connect with. You do not understand it. You do not relate to it in any way. A woman who goes to her local store, her kiosk store, traditional trade as it's called, she'll go to the same one every day and be loyal to the same person. And you'll say, well, why are you being loyal? Are you getting special discounts? And she'll say no. And are you getting special treatment? She'll say, she'll tell you not really, that she just, the person's friendly and it's convenient. Then you'll walk with her to that store, and you'll find that you walk past three or four other stores that were closer to her house. Yet she told you that the reason why she chose this person's store was because it was convenient. And then when you observe her shop, she'll put a couple items, ask for a couple of items, he'll bring them out, and then she'll kind of just wave her hand, and he'll sort of nod, and she'll walk away. And you'll notice that she didn't pay for anything. She doesn't see that as a special service. What she sees that is a sign of respect, that this person knows who she is and knows that she doesn't have the money today, but she'll have the money tomorrow. And that sense of respect and trust is something that has almost disappeared in U.S. retail. You don't walk into Walmart and say, I'll get you later. And that is something that's one particular example of an observation and an insight about, the way people react with each other, the way they trust each other, that I know a lot of people had a very difficult time believing was true, that that's how business is done. And that's just something that, it's just an example of something that may sound like something you don't quite fully believe, but when you listen to the people who are there and they're telling you about it and they're from those areas, you trust them. So I would say that we just need to have tremendous trust in our colleagues in these markets, because they know more than we do in this area. And any person that feels like that they know more than their remote clients or colleagues in these areas is probably making a big mistake.
Very wise advice. Well, Anthony, thank you so much for sharing all of this with the readers of Research World. It's been a pleasure.
Well, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure speaking to you as well.